Now, here's Bill Resnick and Nico Larko talking about the helpful and challenging effects of technology on cities.
Hi, Nico Larko. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you for having me.
Nico Larko teaches architecture and urban design at the University of Oregon. He co-founded and co-directs the Sustainable Cities Initiative. It's easy to Google. A lot of interesting work. The initiative is exploring advances in technology and how cities work and how they could work based on the advances. Nico Larko's blog is Urbanism Next. You can find it just by Googling, which I do, or by actually putting in the whole address, which is
urbanismnext.uoregon.edu.
So, Nico Larko, first, tell us about the new technologies, and particularly autonomous vehicles, which are self-driving cars, and also lots of self-driving transportation things, buses, all sorts of things could be used in this system. And also e-commerce, that is buying things online rather than going to stores. Both of those are likely to have tremendous impacts on the city and also on the suburbs, in fact, the whole country. Give us an overview of what's happening and what the possibilities are, and then we can talk about the problems of it, but also the huge opportunities.
Sounds great. So I'm, as you mentioned, at the University of Oregon here in Portland, just in case any of the listeners are in Portland. And what we've been looking at is we've got a research initiative that we're collaborating with people across the university and across the country where we're looking at the effects of technologies on cities. So we're looking at things like autonomous vehicles, as you mentioned, e-commerce, and also the sharing economy. And we're not as interested in the technology themselves. We're more interested in what we call the secondary effects and how these things are going to be affecting things like city form, land use, the distribution of uses, sprawl, densification, all these types of things that are, on the one hand, directly linked to that technology but go beyond the specific technology. To give you a sense of where we're at, these technologies, which I'm going to say 10 years ago seemed futuristic science fiction, are really right at our doorsteps. So autonomous vehicles are already being tested out on streets around the country. In Pittsburgh, for instance, for more than a year now, you can call up an Uber and step into a car that has someone sitting in the driver's seat but who never actually touches the wheel. So autonomous vehicles are already on the streets. I was just actually at the Autonomous Vehicle Symposium, which is one of the larger conferences on this topic in San Francisco a couple weeks ago, and all the large technology and manufacturing companies are really seeing this technology hitting the streets within the next 5, 10, 15 years. And even 15 years may seem like a long ways off, but when you think about the built environment, which is really on 30 to 50 year cycles, it means we should have been started planning for these things, 15 years ago at least. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, with autonomous vehicles, there's all kinds of reasons that they're going to expand drastically. And part of it is once they become perfected and people get used to them, the companies who put them on the road will not have their labor costs go down by, 80% maybe.
Yeah.
And the cost of them goes down, and just the market is going to push this.
Yeah, so there's great research out there. Rocky Mountain Institute has done some research looking at the costs of, for instance, the ride-sharing services of Uber and Lyft. The large majority of the cost of that trip is actually labor, not surprisingly. And if you have autonomous vehicles, all of a sudden you exchange the labor cost for a capital cost, right? You have to invest in these cars, but then the cost per trip drops dramatically. So that is a real significant kind of issue that's going to be coming up. You also have the issue that it seems that there's one of the people in charge of this technology for GM came out recently and said that they foresee that when this technology does hit the market, it's going to be in the six-figure range for cars. So they don't see a huge market for individuals for a while, but they see a really large market for fleets. So companies like Uber and Lyft, all of a sudden owning these large fleets of vehicles that move around, definitely trucking companies owning fleets of vehicles, could be other transit companies as possible as well. And so that seems to be where the shift is going to happen first. And it is of concern. There's 4 million people in this country whose jobs are driving, and driving jobs are very good-paying jobs for low skills, and so therefore it's hard to think about how the people who are in those jobs would easily transition to other jobs. So that's definitely an issue. There's a lot of equity concerns with these things as well.
And it's not only Uber and Lyft that might do it, but it could be like a public system. What you have is an integrated public system, including buses, trains, light rail, I mean the whole apparatuses, with single vehicles or vehicles with just a few people in them, and some of them are going to be shared, actually, and they're going to have routes. One could imagine a system that really served everybody.
Yep. And, you know, one of the things, the interesting things with transit, which I see as being the easiest transition, there's been a lot of discussion of transit all of a sudden shifting from having a bus driver to having more someone who's customer relations or somehow people on the bus that are helping to make the trip better. So this could be that you're shifting what those people are doing for labor, but it's not necessarily that you're losing labor.
Right. You know, that would be great, though, to provide employment for stand-up comics, which we have a few of in Portland. And sometimes they're not so funny. Anyway, you got new job opportunities. That's a real problem, isn't it, though, the number of people who are going to be displaced?
We're in this bizarre condition where, as I mentioned a few years ago, it was science fiction, and now, as a friend of mine, Jerry Tierney, likes to say, now it's becoming science fact. And the changes are happening very, very quickly. And the secondary effects that we like to call the ramifications of these changes will happen very quickly as well. So even if in the end we had, you know, a zero-sum gain in terms of employment or economics in general, and the disruption is really, I think, something that we need to be aware of and preparing for. Because if you have a whole lot of people shifting jobs, or if you have a whole lot of changes, for instance, in municipal budgets, where money's coming in from and how much things cost, that transition period can be a really dicey one. And that's, I think, something we need to think about. I also want to mention, just so that we don't only focus on autonomous vehicles, we're also talking about e-commerce. That is already having huge effects on our economy. Mm-hmm.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Nico Larko, who teaches architecture and urban design at the University of Oregon. He founded and still co-directs the Sustainable Cities Initiative at the University of Oregon in Portland, actually. We've been talking about the autonomous vehicles and some of the changes that they're going to make in the city, and that they're on their way. And really the question is how we deal with them. And maybe at the end of the interview we can talk about the problem of, in fact, introducing all of these technologies in ways that don't create just more inequality and even more deserts for the poor, and now increasingly the parts of the once middle class, and then playgrounds for the rich. In any event, those are some of the problems. Why don't we go back, though, to this other great change, e-commerce, and how that's going to impact the city.
So first of all, just to kind of set the baseline of how much things are changing, e-commerce is growing tremendously. I think that in this last year it was something like 8% of all commerce that was happening, all retail, and it's expected to double, I think it's in the next 5 or 6 years. Right now, 50% of all sales happen through Amazon, so there's also a big question of how that all works. Incredible statistic that came out just after the holiday season last year was that from this year compared to, or this last holiday season compared to the year before, there was a reduction of the number of people who walked into a store of 12%. So 12% less people went into stores than the year before, over just 1 year, year over year. And so the corollary to that is that eventually we're going to need 12% less stores. And a big driver of that is that so many people are ordering things online. And that has all sorts of ramifications. On the one hand, we're seeing a lot of store closings. So this year is on target, if the rest of the year continues the way it started, that we will have as many store closings this year as we had in the peak of the recession. So with the economy where it's at right now, which is doing much better than it was, you know, in 2008, 2009, we will have more store closings than we did in those years.
Something like, what, 20 or 30% of shopping centers, particularly the sort of low-end shopping centers, they're moving towards bankruptcy fairly rapidly.
Yeah, so I think you're talking about citing there's some research that we talk about on our blog about enclosed malls, and about a third of enclosed malls are predicted to be closing soon because they're just not working anymore, not the direction people are going. So when this store closing kind of happens and the shift to e-commerce happens, it's got a lot of effects on the city. So for instance, one, we no longer have that employment. Two, we no longer have those stores open in our communities. So the access and the secondary benefits that we think of cities, this idea of third places, places that we see each other, places where we build community, will start to go away. You also have this question of blight. You know, one of the worst things that happens when malls shut down is what happens to that property that, you know, used to be a thriving piece of our community, even if it was, you know, kind of more of a strip mall type place. But if it's a closed strip mall and, you know, there's graffiti on it, and, you know, that starts to really be a drain on the area. You also have the question of, not so much in Oregon, but in the rest of the country, the sales tax. Right now, we don't collect sales tax everywhere on online purchases. And when we do start collecting them, the question will be, who collects them? Where's that money go? So cities might see substantial drops in revenue. The same kind of thing is much more true here in Oregon as well, is the question of property taxes, so commercial property taxes. So if you take your typical suburban community and tell them that a third to half of their strip malls are no longer going to be occupied and they'll be vacant, what does that end up doing to the community in terms of both on the fiscal side for the city and all the services it can provide and, you know, kind of staying salient? So, like, how do you deal with that kind of blight that's happening within the community? We just published a report, and if you go again to the website of urbanismnext.uoregon.edu, we just published a report yesterday that we did on the effects of e-commerce and AVs on municipal budgets. We've taken this as a first pass, but we've taken San Francisco's budget and looked at the expense and revenue side and kind of done an analysis of where the impacts might be. And the takeaway is, it's not pretty. There's still not enough information to know the magnitudes of the changes, although it could be fairly painful. But definitely, as I mentioned before, just the transition, just the disruption, I think will be painful for cities.
We're, of course, having tremendous disruption anyway in places like San Francisco, and that's a rich place, and that actually might be able to respond. It's rich and liberal and ready to tax itself to some extent, like Portland. Although both of those are true. Portland and San Francisco are way in the lead in Seattle. And that we have an example of gentrification right now where we leave housing up to the market. And in fact, what we find is communities are disrupted. The rich are taking over central cities. Portland, I think, was maybe the first European city in the United States without any poor people within 5 miles of the downtown. We're moving in that direction, at least. And that the cities, of course, they're rich and liberal, but they are not ready to really tax themselves and do what would be necessary to, in fact, house decently and provide some kind of transport and jobs and opportunities to participate for the majority of the population, who just gets pushed out into social deserts, food deserts, cultural deserts, places without parks. You know, we lavish money on the central city here. East Portland is forgotten, basically, even though everybody pays tribute to, oh, we'll do something.
The mayor, I think, right now is trying to figure this out. It's not an easy problem to fix, but I think Mayor Wheeler's really putting his shoulder into trying to figure this out. I will say, on the whole, I would say that, the topics that we're discussing, autonomous vehicles and e-commerce, the effects on the cities, they frighten me, right? Like, the effects frighten me. But I will say that there are positive things that could be coming out of this. One of the huge ones that has to do with housing costs is just that there's a very good chance we're not going to need parking very much anymore. So right now, your car, most everyone's car, spends 95% parked somewhere. And so, the parking more or less dictates our landscape, and it dictates the cost of housing, because every parking spot costs $250 per space that's added to the cost of rent, if it's automatically included. That's an average around the country. So if you no longer need parking, and the reason you wouldn't need parking is things such as, if we're all taking Lyft everywhere we go, then we just get dropped off and the car goes and does something else. In some ways, it's a much more efficient use of resources. We don't have these big hunks of metal sitting around everywhere waiting for us. And then also, if you have housing that doesn't need parking, the cost of construction goes tremendously down. The amount of land that you need to purchase, the types of construction, so in terms of fire code type safety things, becomes much, much simpler, and you can actually fit more units on any given lot, which means that you can also reduce the overall costs. And so that could help tremendously with affordability and densification. So there's a huge benefit there. The other place that there's a benefit is just with accessibility on the one hand. And people are already seeing this now, especially elderly populations who have trouble getting around, or maybe sometimes even using transit, that Lyft and Uber type services can get them to where they need to go. Right now, say, fairly expensive, but in this future scenario where the prices come down, there's been studies that show that it's going to be 20 to 50 cents a mile. That could increase accessibility for a lot of people. There are these negative effects that come along with it, in terms of, I think there's a big push towards increased sprawl, the kind of job issues that I mentioned before. But it is mixed.
I agree. There are tremendous opportunities for reconstructing sort of the city and the suburbs towards a far more lively, participative, ecologically sensitive, pleasant and fulfilling lives, and public lives as well, and public spaces that are really beautiful. I mean, there's so many things that could happen, but they're only going to happen if resources are sort of used. And the transportation thing, as you point out in your blog, it's a tremendous transition problem, because these vehicles, if they see anything that looks like a human body in their way or anything, they stop. You can have one drunk wandering into a road, and you're going to have a three-mile traffic jam. But because they also go fast and right together, and they just stop, right? I mean, yeah. The whole thing then just starts stopping, and 5 minutes later, they've stopped 5 miles away. All of the planning for that, making it really work, it has to be public, and it has to be done sensitively and with equity concerns. And it's very hard to see that right now, unless we have some kinds of really very large and powerful movements that are interested in environmental justice and equity and having jobs for all, at least good work that's fulfilling. It seems to me it's going to be integrated in ways that just make things less fair and less equitable. And that's my final thing, it seems to me. You'll get the last word.
I would say, when we talk to cities about this, and we talk to state and federal government about this, our big push is that most of the work that's happening right now in terms of policy seems to be around how to accommodate the autonomous vehicle. We'll talk about the autonomous vehicle right now. But how you accommodate them within your city, how do we deal with permitting, how do we deal with data? These are all really important issues. But what we like to push that discussion back towards is the job of a city is not to accommodate an autonomous vehicle. The job of a city is to improve the quality of life of the residents and the citizens there. And so the question to always ask is, how do you want your community to be? And then figure out how you leverage this technology to do that. So making sure that you kind of keep your eye on the ball. And I have to say, Portland is doing a great job with that. The discussions I've had with people around the city, they are not just kind of drinking the Kool-Aid of, oh, these things are coming, what can we do? This is kind of this neat, new, shiny object. They really are, and I think true to a lot of the history of Portland, saying, well, you know, quality of life is really some of the things that are really important to us. Equity is important to us. How do we make sure that these things are helpful? How do we make sure these technologies are helpful to those ends? And how do we set up the regulatory structure to help make that happen? I think there's a lot of unanswered questions, but I think we really need to keep the end goal being, you know, that we all live good, happy lives as the main thing. It's not, we shouldn't be looking at these as technologies for technology's sake.
Yeah, Nico Larko, thanks so much for talking to us. You're really on to something that is going to be profoundly important. I'm hoping that we've wind up with political movements so that the wonderful possibilities that people recognize, and they also recognize the terrible possibilities that they would like to avoid, but in the absence of movements that will politically require it, it seems to me we're going to wind up with dystopic consequences.
I'd encourage everyone to bring these topics to their elected officials and their communities and city staff. Ask them how they're preparing for it. I think that's a really important first step.
Nico Larko, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much. Really
right.
Enjoyed it.
So long.
It's hard to believe it, and it's hard.